Welcome to Symptomatic Redness.
This is our discussion with Jamie Kiriko.
When we talk about politics and art and aesthetics and, you know, I'm one of those people who agrees with you that art is philosophy. And I've always joked that as a person who studied philosophy and anthropology and as a person who studied poetry, if you want to really understand my anthropology in philosophy, you would actually be better served by reading my poetry than listening to everything else I do, which is more explicitly that thing.
I mean, at least for me, it's oftentimes I sort of point counterpoint with myself where, without even realizing it, sometimes at the time, I'll be working on a nonfiction project and sort of working through these ideas, and then I'll do a fiction project, and then only after writing that novel or, you know, illustrated novel or comic or whatever, I look back on it and realize that I was kind of working at the same idea from two different angles.
Yeah, so I mean, I kind of get that too, as a person who does, you know, politics and philosophy and then one end, and as a poet on the other. And what I found interesting about the mythologies and the rhyming character mythology and ideology is interesting, and this which makes the idea, but they're not the same, they just rhyme. This is why you can like contest territory in theological and mythological talk in a way that you kind of can't in pure ideology. Like, we wouldn't be arguing if there's a right-wing Marx. Well, maybe we could. Like, maybe we could, but it'd be pretty hard. Whereas, we can definitely argue over a right and left-wing interpretation of, say, Greek myth or a pop culture story. I mean, like...
Or Nietzsche, for that matter.
Yeah, or Nietzsche, or a philosopher who's more aphoristic, right, instead of systemic. Why do you think... That is.
I think it's the nature of, I mean, we're talking about basically someone like Nietzsche is more sort of, I guess, narratively minded in a way. And what is the narrative, but the story of, you know, who we are and what mother are, right? But I don't know if I can answer that question. I mean, that's a tricky one. I mean, speaking completely honestly, I don't know if I have the answer to it.
Well, interesting to me, I know that there's a big movement to say that right-wing artists aren't like good artists on the liberal left right now, and I've always found that funny because I'm like, Sternhold's a reactionary, and Marx loved him.
Well, this does actually tie into masks. So let me actually bring that up then, because we talk about Yukio Mishima.
Yeah, I was trying to get you to Yukio Mishima because I'm also inspired by him, and you can't get much more right-wing than that.
Uh huh. But he's a perfect example of what we're talking about, though, because he was a nihilist, essentially. I mean, like, he had no strong political leanings up until, you know, I can't remember exactly how many years before the end, but I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't as long as you would think. You know, like, he became very political at the end, but his politics were romanticized in the same way as the sort of romantic stories he told himself, you know, before that point. And so that's been part of the debate about Mishima. I mean, he eventually, you know, for those who don't know, eventually committed seppuku in 1970 as a sort of political statement. Some people interpret it as a political statement. Some people interpret it as almost like, you know, performance art, which has actually had a strange element of quality of that, especially since he'd done a performance not too long before that, where he basically acted out what he did. So it's called patriotism. So, you know, it raises a lot of these questions about the role of an artist in the politics and the role of the artist in God to himself.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an interesting thing about the fascist aesthetic that I find, and I'm using that like explicitly. It's a little bit harder to say Mishima was explicitly fascist, but a whole lot of fascistic art is about like a commitment that is essentially aesthetic and usually kind of late.
Oh, wasn't that Benjamin who said that it was like the ultimate, you know, sort of embodiment of aesthetics is always going to become fascism?
Yeah, I mean, and I find that I think maybe it's the like existential commitment to some kind of authenticity that might be part of it, but also placing a notion of the authentic and the mythic over life itself is probably part of it.
Yeah, and of course, there's a whole complicated, you know, kind of elements of Japanese culture and within that as well, and post World War II, in particular.
Right, which is why I'm a little bit hesitant to say fascist. Also, I tend to be like, you and I have, way in the past argued about this before. I tend to be more of a strict absolutist on my technical designation of what is and is not, purely right. speaking, fascist.
I'm kind of, I see your point with it, and I think in an academic sense, I think you're right. It's just, it's tricky because, unfortunately, if you use any other, like literally any other word, it doesn't get the same reaction. And something can be just, like authoritarianism can be just as bad as that. I mean, you know, fascism is a form of authoritarianism. But if you say authoritarian, people don't have the same reaction. You know, and of course, that can also be a plus and minus, too, because, you know, that can also be an appeal for them, you know. Ooh, so edgy, you know. And that's, you know, that's part of it, too. You say it's reactionary and embodying something that, I mean, I think, you know, in some cases, people don't necessarily believe what they embody, and they, you know, and it eventually takes them in, whereas other people can, you know, do a performance of that sort. You know, it's like, I don't ever wonder if Rammstein are secret, you know, secret right. Nazis. You know, but it's hard to tell from the outside, and that's, you know, you were talking about this before with S. Alexander Leeds, his essay on fascism.
Oh, yeah, essay book that he published, you know, on fascist creep, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that is, you know, hard to tell whether someone is or isn't, you know, if they ever associated with it in the past and they say they've given it up, how do you determine? It's tricky.
Right. It's very tricky. And it's one of those things, like, and there are authors that I like aesthetically, right, who struggle with it their entire lives in ways that make it very hard to know if they are or aren't. I think of, like, Ciaran or Coran or however you say his name, the Romanian, who was clearly a fascist at one point in his life. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. Mm-hmm. But is all his writing fascistic after he formally parted ways? I mean, it's really... What right. elements remain, what elements don't. I mean, Heidegger, you struggle with that. Although Heidegger, I think it's clear that it's more in it, like, fascism is somehow integral to his philosophy.
Yeah.
Although that's highly debated, you know.
Sure. But that, yeah, but the idea of sort of embeddedness in the folk, you know, folk, whatever, yeah, that definitely has that tinge of fascism to it, the homeland. Yeah.
That to me, you know, to me, these things are, there's no real easy answer to them, frankly. Like, we're not going to get a good answer to a lot of these things. But, I do
those are usually the things I like the most, are the things you can sort of, that you keep questioning, you know, like that Japanese approach to fiction as well, where you don't have a, you know, clear ending.
So to bring you back to Mass, so Mishma inspires you to look into this, and then Bowie dies. We were talking about that. That was a clear motivating, you know, like what we would use in fiction talk, inciting incident for this kind of scholarly work. What about mm-hmm. that really prompted you?
I mean, it was complicated, and trying to work out sort of what caught me was part of the, you know, first 6 to 12 months of figuring out the project, really was sort of being taken by it and figuring out, like, what is this, you know, this association? Because at first I didn't even know that there was a direct connection between Bowie and Mishima when I started the project. It happened, you know, very quickly, I realized. But, you know, so Bowie was a longtime fan of Mishima, you know, and actually, you know, some of his later work, he has a song that's directly related to you know, one of Mishima's books. So after he died, let's see, I was really like a fan of Bowie when I was a kid, when I was 16, 17, but not, you know, his early work, but certainly most old Ziggy and whatnot. And of course, I was familiar with it. But as When Outside came out, it like completely changed my outlook on art. And it was the sort of hidden narratives that, like, I mean, he didn't really fully deliver on them. And that's kind of the thing with Bowie, you know, honestly.
Yeah, it's a promised sequel we never got.
Yeah, oh sure, exactly. And sequel is supposed to be one every year, and, you know, it didn't happen. You know, things don't always pan out, I guess. But
or it was a stunt in the first place, and I never intended to do it. You never know with Bowie.
So that's where he first pulled me in with that. So I was interested in Bowie before that, but it was, you know, when he died that I thought, started thinking about the process of turning yourself into a work of art. Which, of course, I mean, Bowie, the character Bowie was, you know, that's what it was. And he comments on that in Black Star. So you know, his final album was kind of what I started with, and then I worked backwards from there. And, you know, the connection with Mishima, aside from with Bowie's work, was the fact that both of them were incorporated within their work, you know, and made a character of themselves who was in their work with Mishima, you know, his first novel. So, yeah, that's where it started and kind of how it grew.
To hear the complete discussion, please subscribe to our Patreon feed.